Hello and welcome to the Paranormal or What podcast. I'm your host, Michaela Ford. Hello everybody, how have you been doing this week? I've been doing really well and I'm very excited because this weekend I'm going on a ghost hunt and I haven't been on one for ages and ages. So this week on the podcast we've got lots of stories that I've been reading from my very, very favourite true ghost book. Also, we've got some listeners' stories provided by one of our listeners, Emma from France, originally from West Yorkshire, the same as me. And we've also got a trailer from one of our fellow podcast people, the Prairieland Podcast. So I hope you're going to enjoy this week's stories. Get yourself snuggled down in that armchair with your blanket. And snuggle up, of course, as usual, with something hot and fiery. Or if that's not your bag, or your cup as it were, just something hot will do to snuggle down with. Are you ready? It's gonna be a spooky ride tonight. Here we go. The first story from the True Ghosts book that I'm going to share with you is called The Poor Musician. Now, bear in mind that all of these stories are purported to be true. So this is The Poor Musician from A Westminster Childhood by John Rayner. I was born on 5th of June 1909 at breakfast time. This caused my father displeasure as he had to leave his boiled egg, which had just cracked, upon hearing the news, but in any case he never cared to be disturbed at breakfast. The scene of my birth was in a room which was two tall flights of stairs above the dining room, so that when my father at last got back to his egg, it was quite cold, the toast flabby, and the coffee bitter. Nor was a new meal possible, as he had to begin teaching his class at 9. However, both he and I survived this unfortunate beginning. My father was master of the King's Scholars at Westminster School, so I had the good fortune to live at No. 3, Little Dean's Yard, an 18th-century house in the inmost court of an inner court, the quietest and dreamiest place in London. Footsteps echoed sharply in the silence there, and the chimes of Big Ben and the clock of Westminster Abbey fell through the air like coloured stars against the hushed distant traffic. I inherited from my Scottish mother a deep awareness of unexplainable things, but then she was the seventh child of a seventh child, and any Scot will tell you that such a person is bound to have the gift of second sight. As a small child I never questioned certain feelings and knowledge that I had, but accepted them as I accepted my 10 toes or the colour of my eyes. If I knew things that other people didn't, and was afraid of them, then that was how it was. The question, "Do you believe in ghosts?" always interested me. I myself have never seen one with my physical eyes, but with the inward eye I certainly have. And then again, I have certainly heard them with my physical ears, and smelt one with my physical nose. Sometimes only a state of intense awareness is present, spinning horrible and black, or occasionally a crystal clear and pure awareness. But I have often felt a presence, a something that is going very soon to manifest itself. Our house was huge, had 4 stories, and was old and rambling. There was a front staircase and a back staircase that was useful for escaping from punishment of some misdeed, but it was so horribly haunted that it was far worse than most ordinary punishments. Yet it was an exciting house to live in, full of unexpected cupboards and dark passageways, dimly lit at night. Every landing, every staircase, every room had its own smell and atmosphere, and its own ghosts. I cannot now remember exactly when I first heard the sounds, but I was certainly not more than 4, I was sleeping in Nurse's room at the time of the first sound, right at the top of the house. One night I was lying awake, sleepless, when a strange, quiet, metallic buzzing started. I listened for a moment, and then my heart began to beat furiously, and I buried my head under the bedclothes. Still I could hear the sound as clearly as before. I turned and twisted, trying to escape from it, but in vain. Then suddenly it stopped, and after a few moments, when I felt fairly certain that it would not start again, I fell asleep. From then onwards, night after night it would come, and I would lie awake, sometimes for hours, waiting for it, while the nightlight burned steadily away in its saucer of water, and suddenly, with a splutter and heave of flame, the flame would go out and plunge the room into darkness. Then the noise would start, the quiet but penetrating musical buzzing, sometimes high, sometimes low, but always constant in volume. It was filled with sadness rather than fear, and I think that I knew it was powerless to harm me, for I never felt it for unreasoning terror, only a kind of sick awe and a devout hope that it would not start. About a year later, I was promoted to my brother Harold's bedroom, and it was there that I heard an infinitely more terrible sound. Again, I was lying sleepless in bed when it started. It was like the other sound, but was greatly intensified and seemed to come from far away in the street, from the foot of the bed and from inside my own head at one and the same time. The sound itself was a terrible whirring flutter, minute yet loud, the embodiment of all hatred and fear. It would rise like a little angry scream and die away to a low moan. It was completely aware of me. The first time I heard it, I was paralysed with fear. I lay under the bedclothes, shivering in uncontrollable spasms. It was term time. Harold was away at school, and I was all alone. I tried to call for Nurse or Mother, but the steady waves of fear that gripped my throat prevented any sound coming out. At last, it was stopped. But for a long time I lay awake, staring into the darkness, till at last I could fight against tiredness no longer. The noise, or rather the waiting for the noise, began to play havoc with my nerves. For nights at a stretch it would be absent, sometimes for as long as a week. Then suddenly, without warning, there it was. I would be warm and drowsy, on the point of falling asleep, and suddenly that vile fluttering whine would start, from the bed, from the street, from my head, infinitely far away and as near me as the pillow. After a time I managed to tell Mother about it, and she would come and sit by my bed until I fell asleep. Then, after she had gone right downstairs again, I would sometimes suddenly wake and lie still for a moment, burdening with a dreadful knowledge, and tense, shrunk within myself, I would hear it start. It seemed to have some kind of intelligence, for on Friday nights, when Mother had to attend a meeting, it never failed to put in an appearance. For several months I was tormented. I grew pale and thin, and no one knew why. At that time I had no way of expressing the full extent of my feelings. The climax arrived suddenly in the early summer of 1914. Mother had suggested that the sound was probably due to one of the chimney cowls in the yard turning in the wind on unoiled bearings. I tried my very hardest to believe this, and the knowledge that that was what Mother thought succeeded in slightly easing my fear. Then, one night, early in June, I woke suddenly to hear that sound very loud and clear. I got out of bed, shivering with fright, climbed onto the chest of drawers, drew back the curtains and looked out of the window, determined to prove to myself whether the sound did indeed come from a turning cowl. It was a night of brilliant moon. The yard and the abbey shone spectrally cold and clear. Every cowl was visible in the flooding light. The night was absolutely still and silent, breath held in its utter tranquillity. and no cowl was moving. The most terrible horror I have ever known seized me. The sound rose in pitch, fluttering with shrill evil, on and on, clear, deathly and small. Crouching there on the chest of drawers, the last pretence of comfort removed, I began to scream and scream uncontrollably. The sound brought nurse hurrying to me. She looked at me and ran to fetch mother. Without a word, I was lifted down, safe at last in comforting arms, and carried straight to mother's bed for the rest of the night. In the morning, a doctor came and talked to me and smiled kindly down upon me. In the afternoon, I was taken into the country to spend the next 6 weeks with my grown-up sister, Edith. Years later, mother mentioned to me that the doctor, puzzled beyond words, had insisted on this immediate change of surroundings, as I was in great danger at the age of 5 of a nervous breakdown, and no one understood, except probably my mother, the real reason. When I grew up, and only a few months before her death, my mother and I were talking together one day. We had somehow got on to the subject of ghosts, a subject that mother intensely disliked. I asked her to call me anything, to tell me anything she knew about our house and the college. She hesitated. "What do you want to know?" she asked. "What you felt," I said. "It was a terribly haunted house. You knew that?" "Yes," I said. "I tried to make them feel happier," she said unexpectedly. I waited. The little boy in the drawing-room was terribly unhappy. I used to talk to him, but nothing seemed to make it much better. Twice in the 30 years I lived there I saw him. He was about 11, and he wept bitterly and silently. Then there was your sister's room. I don't know, I never felt much there, but father told me how he once slept there before I married him, and though he fought it, he had to get up in the middle of the night and make a bed for himself in another room. Why? I asked. What did he see? I don't know, mother replied. He never would even tell me. Mother was silent for a moment. Then she said with extraordinary passion, "College dormitory! Oh, how I hated that! The smell and the brooding and the other world feeling and, oh, it was hateful! There is a story about that, you know," she said slowly. "A boy died in college. He was about 15. He was ill and was put to bed and looked after in the room at the top of the house. This poor boy played the Jew's harp. He's supposed to come through from college into our house and wander about between the back stairs and nurse's room, playing his Jew's harp. He's been seen and heard. I never met him myself, and I never heard him." She stopped and looked at me. "You're white," she said. "I wish you hadn't made me tell you all this." "I'm very glad," I said. "I can't think why you never told me earlier. Did you know about Harold's room, where I heard that terrible sound?" "No," she said, "nothing. But I didn't always care for the feeling of it, and it is supposed to be the oldest part of the house." "Did this boy play the Jew's harp well?" "I believe he's supposed to be a very indifferent performer," said mother. I smiled. Suddenly, looking closely at me, she said, "You heard him? Oh, John, when?" "When I slept in nurse's room."
"Did you ever see him?"
"No, but why didn't you tell me all this? It would have explained so much."
"I didn't dare tell you," said my mother, "because I didn't think, once you'd known, you could have gone on living in that house. I was right, was I not?"
The following day I went out and bought a Jew's harp, an instrument that I had never seen or heard, and took it to a friend who said he could play it. I suppose that he was right. He certainly played it better than the dead boy, but not a great deal better.
This story is called The Late Nellie Butler.
Machiasport is an old New England town in America, lying close to the village of Machias. The whole area, which lies to the north of the state of Maine, has many old houses in it, some dating back to the first settlers in New England. The people of Machiasport were God-fearing, industrious, stubborn, and canny. In the early days of the American nation, they were mainly of Scottish, Irish, and English descent. Some of the things they most detested were Tory Englishmen, all Frenchmen, Redskins, and occult matters. Can I just say that this was written quite a long time ago, so I'm sorry for the non-PC references there. Not many years had passed since witches had been terribly persecuted in New England, and in many cases burned at the stake. They had no wish to be reminded of this. In 1799 there lived near Machiasport one Abner Blaisdell, a man with a fine and untarnished reputation, an honest, reliable fellow, and a staunch member of the church. On the night of the 9th of August, 1799, a disembodied voice suddenly announced loudly and abruptly in the Blaisdell home that an apparition was shortly going to appear. Abner, mindful of the results if his neighbours were told of this event, imposed a strict rule of silence on the members of his household who had heard the disembodied voice. For 5 months nothing happened. The Blaisdells, although at a loss to explain it, began to wonder if in fact they had heard a voice at all. Then, on 20th of January 1800, the voice spoke out again, strongly and purposefully. It belonged to a woman. She said she was the deceased wife of a neighbour, Captain George Butler. Her maiden name had been Nellie Hooper, daughter of David Hooper. The voice told the Blaisdells to send someone at once for its father, old David Hooper, who resided some 6 miles away. It was a nasty night, cold and bitter. The 6 mile trip was not going to be pleasant, and yet there was no question that the disembodied voice belonged to someone or something that would stand for no excuses. The trip was duly made. Later, shaken but gratified after speaking with Nellie, David Hooper signed a statement that the visitor had given such clear tokens of her being the spirit of my own daughter that I could only feel admiration and delight. Until now, Nellie had simply been a voice. But later that same month, Abner's son Paul was crossing a field and saw in the distance the silhouette of a woman. She came directly towards him, seeming, so he said, to float rather than walk. Paul, unable to speak, stood silent until she had passed. That was the first sighting of what became known as the spectre, otherwise Nellie Hooper Butler. The following evening, Nellie appeared in the house, scolded Paul for not speaking to her, and vanished. There were two obvious factors about those events. One, Nellie had evidently come to stay. Two, after David Hooper's excited recitation of his daughter's return, Abner's excellent reputation was in danger. Nellie did not reappear during February, to the Blaisdells' relief, but in March she returned, and her imperious manner insisted that Abner, Paul and their wives go to talk to her in the cellar. No one was at ease in the cold and dark cellar, but Nellie talked for 2 hours in spite of the discomfort, and during this time told the Blaisdells that although her body had turned to dust in the grave, my soul is as much alive as before I left the body. As before, Nellie did not return for a month, but in May she was back again, and this time was seen by several people. She was also distinctly heard by others, and a great number swore that while they had heard a loud voice, they could not distinguish the words. All this helped to save Abner's reputation, but he and his family said candidly they wished Nellie would do her visiting elsewhere. But at least it was no longer possible for people to laugh at the Blaisdells only. In fact, as time passed and Nellie busily appeared in a number of different places, people were becoming seriously concerned with who and what Nellie was. When Nellie first appeared, Even before she became visible, the Blaisdells, adults and children alike, were very much afraid of her. The children moved their beds into their parents' room and acted as subdued as any frightened children would act. This annoyed Nelly, and she spoke to the youngsters, saying, "Be not afraid. You need not be. I haven't hurt you, have I? And I shall not hurt you now, so put your things back in place." The children's beds were duly moved back where they belonged, and Nelly never did, in fact, harm the children, nor anyone else, although her presence more often than not caused goosed pimples and fluttery hearts. There were three remarkable things about this ghost. First, that she usually wore a long, loose-fitting white dress. Second, that when she was finally visible, people who had known Nellie Hooper alive recognised her at once. Third, that shrill, bossy Nellie had not mellowed after death and showed the same curiosity about other people's affairs she had shown in life. Nellie's notoriety spread, and the Blaisdells had to play host to a stream of neighbours and total strangers. This, added to their other discomforts, did not make them any fonder of Nellie, whose liking for their cellar suggested that she found it ideally suited to her purposes. At one of those cellar meetings, in early August of 1800, a visitor named Mary Gordon said, "I heard such a voice speaking to us as I never heard before or since. It was shrill, but mild and pleasant." Later, Nellie appeared. Mary Gordon recorded that event thus. "At first, the apparition was a mere mass of light, then grew into personal form, about as tall as myself. She passed and repassed, so that any of us could have touched her. Yet when she passed me by, she was so near that if there had been a substance, I should certainly have felt it. The glow of the apparition constantly vibrated. At last the personal form became shapeless, expanded, and then vanished in a moment." Nellie, who hadn't done too much harm up until now, caused a scandal when she ordered her former husband, George Butler, to marry Lydia Blaisdell. Everyone in the Blaisdell household was shocked. These two, having been mildly attracted to one another before Nellie interfered, were suddenly embroiled in a family quarrel, for Abner refused to agree to this match. Lydia, too, refused to consent or even to see Captain Butler again. Butler, on the other hand, was willing. When he pressed Lydia, not unreasonably, she told him that under no circumstances would she marry a man who'd been frightened into proposing to her by a ghost. Captain Butler insisted that his proposal was genuine. Lydia wavered, but when some sceptics said there was no ghost, and that Lydia Blaisdell had been dressing up as one to get George Butler to propose to her, she was furious. She decided to go away, to leave the area completely. Captain Butler had had about all he could stand. He followed Lydia, and in the end persuaded her to change her mind. Love won the day, and they were soon married. To the dismay of those who had claimed Lydia had been imitating a ghost to catch a husband, Nellie continued to appear. In fact, she was more active than ever, but she also visited Captain Butler to inform him his bride would not live past their first year of married life. She was correct. 10 months after marriage, Lydia gave birth to a child and died the day after. Another time, when Abner Blaisdell asked about the health of his father, who lived at a distance in York, Maine, Nellie, without hesitation, replied that the elder Blaisdell was dead. Abner wrote off at once and shortly afterwards received a reply confirming that his father had died 7 days prior to the day he asked Nellie about him. Among those who firmly rejected Nellie from the first, even though they saw her and recognised her, was Nellie's married sister, whose name was Sally Wentworth. Sally was of the opinion that the spectre who looked, acted and even spoke like her sister was a reasonable copy, handcrafted in hell by the devil. Nelly now appeared to be quite devout. But in life, those who had known her had never considered her a religious person. Her own explanation was that she had felt the presence of God on her deathbed. In fact, Nelly never failed to have an answer for anything. She was very forthright and opinionated, and although she would certainly tell of some events before they had occurred, she did not have any really startling revelations or prophecies to offer either. She seemed, in fact, to be very little changed from the way she had been in life. Once energetic Nelly organised a hike. She had all the people at the Blaisdell residence line up two by two and march out across the countryside for a mile or more, then march back again. In this procession was her successor, Lydia Blaisdell Butler, who walked with her discomfited husband. Nelly floated along beside George and Lydia all the way out and all the way back. Nelly Butler was visible and audible for about one full year. As the Machias ghost, she attracted considerable attention, caused a large number of statements, all essentially agreeing, to be written and signed by an entire community that had known her in either or both of her forms. Then she simply stopped either visually or audibly appearing, alive or ghostly, and was never seen of or heard again. If Nelly Butler was simply an ordinary everyday ghost, what force or lack of force induced her to fade away? It seems highly unlikely that an entire community would see the identical hallucination, or that if she was simply the result of imaginings, she would have been able to do or say the things she did. Nelly was not a welcome apparition, yet this did not bother her one bit. Even for those people to whom she wouldn't talk, there was one disturbing fact that could not be disputed. Nelly was just as blunt, nosy and domineering in death as she had been in life. She was, in fact, such a perfect example of her living self that everyone who had known her on Earth was forced to admit that Nelly hadn't changed one little bit. I must admit, I do quite like the sound of Nelly. Wouldn't it be amazing to just be able to have a full conversation with a ghost who you could see? That would be fabulous. I'd love to be able to do that one day. Well, here's hoping. If I go to enough investigations, you never know. This is one of my favourite stories from this book, and also one of my favourite ghost stories. It's a very famous case, and it's called The Talking Mongoose by Christine Bernard. In years gone by, the people living on the Isle of Man, cut off as they were from the mainland by the Irish Sea, had a language of their own. It was called Manx. This language has fallen into disuse, but some of the words remain in its place names. Dawlish Cashan, a remote old farmhouse, is one such. Dawlish means gap in Manx, and Cashan's Gap was the name given to this house, perched on the side of Dolby Mountain on the west coast of the Isle of Man. Our story begins a long time ago, in 1931, when a family called Irving were living there. Mr. Irving was an educated man who had travelled widely, and his house was rather better furnished than you might have expected, with comfortable chairs and pretty cushions, while on the walls were many pictures of other countries, one of a tattooed Maori chief and some street scenes in Istanbul. He knew German and some Russian, Arabic, Yiddish, even Hindustani. So, for a start, he was no ordinary farmer. However, like any other farmer, he looked after a flock of sheep and some goats and poultry on his 45 acres of rough grass. His wife was a tall, striking-looking woman who believed she had psychic powers. Their daughter, Vori, 13 years old when this story begins, was much the youngest of the family, her brother and sister having grown up and left home some years earlier. She was a tall girl with greenish-brown eyes and long fair hair, who had no friends of her own age. She was very quiet and reserved. Now, Cashin's Gap had one unique feature. When Mr. Irving bought his bleak farmhouse, he found it very draughty, exposed as it was to violent winds and having no trees or shelter of any kind around it. So he built a thin inner wall throughout the house of wooden matchboard, leaving a space of about a foot between the old walls and the new. This certainly warmed the house, and may perhaps have had something to do with the extraordinary events that occurred over the next 4 years. One September evening, the Irvins were sitting round the fire in the living room. They were tired and feeling ready for bed, particularly Vorry, who had had a long day. She was always up first, making tea and milking the goats, and today she had been tramping the moors with Mona, her brown sheepdog, and picking late flowers, mushrooms and bilberries. She'd also found a couple of rabbits in the snares set by her father the previous evening. For the Irvings were poor and depended largely on rabbit and their own chicken for their main food. Suddenly they heard a tapping sound coming from the attic. Tap, tap, tap. The noise stopped and the little growling noises began. "We must have mice," said Mrs. Irving. "Sounds more like a weasel to me," said Mr. Irving. Vuari, as usual, said nothing, but she looked thoughtfully at the ceiling. Next day Mr. Irving climbed up to the attic and almost immediately found a little wooden carving, which he had picked up on his travels in India. He was astonished to find it there, and was about to complain to Vuari when he had an idea. He dropped it onto the wooden floor of the attic, and found it made exactly the same sound they'd all heard the evening before. A sharp wooden tap. Mystified and intrigued, he decided to leave it where it was for the time being. That same evening the tapping came again, but this time louder. Then it became a running noise. "That's no mouse," Mr. Irving exclaimed. Immediately came the sound of a series of animal noises, barking, growling, hissing and spitting. Suddenly there was a violent crack, as of a whip, but so strong that it set the pictures on the wall swinging even. The family were thoroughly unnerved and quite speechless with apprehension by now, and even more so when Mr. Irving repeated the animal noises, only to find that the creature, whatever it was copying him. "Vow, vow," said Mr. Irving. "Vow, vow," said the creature. And then, in a tiny, whistling, high-pitched voice, said, "Dog!" When he had recovered from the shock, Mr. Irving called, "Meow!" And back came the answer, "Meow! Cat!" Mr. Irving and his family were carried away in wonder. An animal taking lessons in human speech? Of course, they set about searching for this creature. Every nook and cranny, behind every cupboard, in cracks and corners, though they were hampered by the wooden partition and could only feel a short way into its depths through one or two odd openings. Over the next few days the experiment was repeated, not once but many times. At that time, however often Mr. Irving and it conversed, none of the family could see it. They only heard the high, shrill, disembodied little voice, and various thumpings, tappings, and so on, all over the house. By the beginning of November, it spoke quite fluently, using all their daily words and lots of others. It never stopped asking questions, and had a huge thirst for knowledge. "One more question, Jim," it used to plead to Mr. Irving, "then I'll let you go to sleep." Vuari, too, taught it all the nursery rhymes, and by December the creature was speaking fluently. He told them that for years he had understood everything that people said, but that he could not speak until he was taught by Mr. Irving, who, incidentally, had begun to call him Jack. Mr. Irving discovered that some 20 years earlier a nearby farmer, by an odd coincidence his name had been Irving, had got hold of a number of mongooses. which are small, four-footed, weasel-like creatures common in India and able to kill poisonous snakes. And he had released them in the fields to get rid of a plague of rabbits. Yet when Mr. Irving suggested that Jack must be the descendant of one of them, he said no, that he was born on the 7th of June, 1852, came from Delhi in India, and had been chased and shot at by natives. In the first alarming weeks, a state of war existed between the farmer and Jack, and Mr. Irving confessed to feeling afraid. Was this a ghost? He wondered. Jack encouraged this belief and said, I am a ghost in the form of a weasel, and I shall hunt you with weird noises and clanking chains. Which was really a very ordinary idea of a ghost. Yet, around the same time, he also said, If you are kind to me, I will bring you good luck. If you are not kind, I shall kill your poultry. But I am not evil, though I could be if I wanted. You don't know what harm I could do if I were roused. I could kill you all if I wanted. At this stage, the creature became aggressive and rude and developed a habit of throwing all kinds of things into the living room with great force. This both frightened and angered the Irvings, although no one still had seen him. Mr. Irving decided that the time had come to get rid of Jack, but though one or other of them caught, out of the corner of their eye, a dim shadow of a bushy tail as it whisked out of sight, or perhaps a little paw thrust through a gap in the wall, no one could actually claim to have seen Jack. So, of course, it was impossible to catch or kill him. In this aggressive period, his language, too, was terrible, and Dwari's bed was moved into another room, her parents hoping that she wouldn't be able to hear Jack's disgraceful vocabulary. But as this phase passed and the creature became less hostile, he began to go into fits of screaming, keeping the horrified Irvings awake and distraught for hours. The nights were full of groans and sighs as if someone was in agony. Then, as suddenly as he began, Jack stopped his nocturnal noises. "What was all that ghastly screaming about, then?" Mr. Irving asked Jack, who had been quite silent for several days and had only now made his presence felt by a tiny scratching noise. The voice answered immediately, "I did it for devilment." Soon his behaviour greatly improved, until he became quite affectionate, speaking cheerfully to all the family. Now he changed his name to a softer version of Jack, asking to be called Jeff, and the name stuck. When the Irvins occasionally mentioned leaving the house because the farm was not going too well, Jeff grew alarmed. "Would you go away and leave me?" he asked. "Yes," said Mrs. Irving. "You haven't helped us, though you promised to." "I got rabbits for you," he said sulkily. This was true. Quite often Dwari found a dead rabbit near the back door, killed long before either she or Mona were up and about. During his years at Cashin's Gap, Jeff killed 71 rabbits for the Irvings. Mrs. Irving replied, "Maybe, but you promised to help us make money, and you haven't done so." "No," said Jeff, with both spirit and insight. "For if you make money, you'll go away and leave me," he continued. "The house holds three attractions for me. I follow Dwari, Mam gives me food, and Jim answers my questions." Well, as you can imagine, it was not long before word of the astonishing happenings in the remote farmhouse reached the outside world. News of the mystery farmhouse reached London in October 1931, when the Daily Sketch published a photograph of the Irvings' cottage with the caption, "The Talking Weasel Farm," while the Daily Mail and other newspapers reported strange events at Dawlish Cashin. Early in 1932, Manchester's Daily Dispatch sent a reporter to the Isle of Man, and this is what he wrote the next day in his column. "The mysterious man-weasel has spoken to me today. Investigation of the most remarkable animal story that has ever been given publicity leaves me in a state of perplexity. Had I heard a weasel speak? I do not know,
but I do know that I have heard today a voice which I should never have imagined could issue from a human throat, that the people who live there seem sane, honest and responsible folk, and not likely to indulge in a difficult, long-drawn-out and unprofitable practical joke, and that others have had the same experience as myself. Soon after this, Harry Price received a letter from Mr. Irving telling him of their strange new inhabitant. Harry Price and R.S. Lambert were two investigating officers for the Society of Psychical Research. At that time, Mr. Lambert was editor of the BBC's The Listener. The chairman of the London County Council said Mr. Lambert was crazy for believing in the talking mongoose. Mr. Lambert, who had been as startled as you or I would have been if we'd ever heard Jeff, was naturally annoyed at being dubbed mad and promptly sued the chairman. After a sensational trial, he was awarded £7,500 damages. All those years ago, this was a lot of money. Over the next 4 years, Cashin's Gap had a lot of visitors. Apart from many sightseers, Harry Price and R.S. Lambert came down to investigate, and although they didn't see Jeff, they certainly heard him. Later, they wrote a book about their investigations and called it The Haunting of Cashin's Gap. Well, so who did see him? Mr. Irving wrote to Harry Price in 1932. The animal has been seen by myself and daughter in one of the two bedrooms of my house on several occasions. My daughter has twice seen, its tail only, in the small back kitchen in a hole in the wall. My wife has seen it on only one occasion. The colour is yellow, the tail is long and bushy, tinged with brown. My daughter says the face is all yellow, and the shape is more that of a hedgehog, but flattened at the snout like the domestic pig. Jeff described himself as a little clever, extra clever mongoose, and was clearly very shy and nervous of being seen. His fingers were once seen through a crack near the ceiling, and were short, yellow, and the nails curved. But Jeff allowed all his fingers to be touched. Mrs. Irving was even allowed to stroke his fur and put her middle finger into Jeff's mouth. It seemed to fill it, she said. His teeth were tiny and sharp. He drew a little blood from my finger. I was indignant. I told him, I don't want any blood poisoning. He answered, go and put ointment on it. But many people, family, visitors, researchers heard him, and he was certainly worth hearing. Indeed, this is one of the reasons I'm telling you the story of Jeff. He said such extraordinary funny things. Two local boys, Harry Hall and Will Cubbon, called on the farm one day. Harry told his story. Mr. Irving told us that Jeff can tell the head or tail of a penny if it is placed on the porch window. I took a penny from my pocket, tossed it and placed it on the window ledge. As soon as I came back into the kitchen, Jeff shouted, tails! He was right. I tossed again. He was right again. Then I did not toss again, but left the penny as it was. Jeff said, you did not toss the penny. The voice was very high, screechy sort. I never heard one like it. Sometimes Jeff went away for days. He would roam the countryside, enter people's houses, and listen to all sorts of private gossip. Folk were uneasy. That mongoose knows far too much, they said. Once, mischievously, he threw gravel at the window of a lonely cottage. The female was hiding behind a door, he reported back. Then the father came out with a whacking big stick. Will Cubbon, one of the boys who witnessed the penny incident, reported that Jeff asked him, can you drive a steamroller? Will said yes, he could. Jeff did not believe him. Sorry. You young rascal, he cried. You would put it over a hedge. Clear to hell. Jeff was very fond of the word hell. After visiting a country estate 20 miles away, he told the Irvings about his adventures when he got home. He had had, he said, a hell of a job to climb over the wire net, which surrounded the estate. He had got there under a lorry, and when the Irvings pointed out that he might have been seen or killed by dogs, he replied, "Oh, God, was I tired?" Asked how he dared to do it, he replied simply, "I watch like hell." Jeff gathered much local information from listening to people talking in buses, under which, too, he always travelled. Hearing that the talking mongoose was stealing bus rides, the electrician at the town bus terminus cruelly set up a contact plate under the bus to electrocute Jeff. Irving heard of this and warned Jeff. "Oh," he replied carelessly, "I know all about it. It's under bus 81. Irving inquired and found that Jeff's knowledge was entirely accurate. His character, at least measured by the things he said, was by turns cheeky, quarrelsome, jeering, pathetic and brave. Here are some of the things he said that were recorded at various times, either by the Irvings or their friends. He would sometimes make the most absurd claims, rather like a small child's bragging. "I am the fifth dimension," and "I am the eighth wonder of the world." In his conversations with the Irvings, he would speak as to a contemporary. "Hey, Jim," he would call to Mr. Irving when hungry, "how about some grubbo?" Having helped himself one day in the larder, he called to Mrs. Irving, "Maggie, I hope you don't mind. I've eaten the bacon." One day he saw a box of chocolates that had been sent to Voiry. He was asked if he was hungry and replied, "Yes, I will have some of those chocolates, a nut and a black paradise and a muck sweet." Evidently he learned his words from listening to people, and whenever he heard new words he would call, "Hey, Jim, what is countenance? What is loco? What is a nun?" And then would shout back, "Honest, Jim, word of honour, Jim." One day he saw Mr. Irving reading the Bible. "Look," he cried to Maggie, "look at the pious old atheist reading the Bible. He'll swear in a minute." Most amusing of all, Jeff was afraid of ghosts. Mr. Irving told an inquirer of the incident one evening. "While sitting on the bed, I heard Jeff talking to my wife and daughter below. I put a sheet round my head, took off my boots and slipped silently downstairs. When I crept into the kitchen, Jeff screamed with fright, 'Ah, clear to hell!' When I took the sheet off, he sobbed like a child." Well, these and many other similar stories make up the extraordinary tale of the talking mongoose. Like so many other strange stories, this one too has an unsatisfactory ending. In the last months of 1935, 4 years after Jeff's sudden arrival, the Irvings sold Dawlish Cashen and vanished. Jeff might have gone with them, or of course he might have died. In 1947, the new owner of the farm claimed he shot a queer-looking animal that looked like a mongoose. He thought it must have been Jeff because he said the house was no longer haunted. And what are we to make of Jeff? A lot of theories were put forward at the time. That he was a ghost, a poltergeist, a familiar from the world of witchcraft, and he does remind me a bit of Nellie Butler, or an earthbound spirit in animal form. It is said that some Indian fakirs possess the power to make mongooses talk, and we mustn't forget that those that had been released in the district 20 years earlier to kill the overpopulous rabbits. Talking animals from Balaam's ass to the Elberfield horses have long been with us and continue to puzzle mankind. Whatever the explanation, a lot of people who were sane, intelligent, rational human beings heard, not once, but several times, a small, lively creature talking like a human being and talking very obviously with human intelligence behind his speech. No one has been able to come up with a rational explanation, though you may think that a Dr. Maxwell telling of Leeds did, perhaps, come nearer the truth when he said that Jeff was a missing link between the animal and human intellect. In earlier days, there's no doubt that all three Irvings would have been burnt as witches, because our ancestors did believe in an irrational and dangerous spirit world, and they never questioned their right to destroy those they considered agents of that world. But we in our day have cast away, perhaps to our loss, belief in both good and bad spirits, and can only believe what is rational and open to scientific explanation. Perhaps it could be that once in a while, the powers of lightness and darkness send us reminders of the existence of another world of the spirit. Don't you just love Jeff the Mongoose? I'd love to have a pet that could talk. That would be amazing, wouldn't it? And now we have something very special for you. We have some stories all the way from West Yorkshire via France. From Emma, you wait until you hear these. It will definitely send tingles down your spine. Take it away, Emma.
Hi, Michaela. It's Emma from Spine Chillers and Serial Killers. I thought I'd send you a few spooky stories from my childhood. We are both from Yorkshire. We have that in common, so I know exactly where Halifax is. I'm from West Yorkshire. And when I was about 10, we moved to France. So I live in France at the minute. But yeah, all the spooky stuff that happened all happened in Yorkshire. So maybe Yorkshire is just like a really spooky place. So it all began when I was about 5 or 6. We moved house. My dad got a new job. He got a job running a college for teaching students. So we got a house that came with a job that were on the grounds of this massive manor house that was the college. So this really beautiful old building is where my dad worked, and our house was up the grounds, really. We were about 5-minute walk from it. The first thing I can remember happening was I used to get woken up every single morning by somebody going, "Emma," right in my ear. And there was nobody there. But at the time, I don't know why, I just didn't really think much of it. I suppose I just assumed it was a normal thing. And also, I used to get lots of noise inside my head, like almost as if you're in a busy restaurant and you can hear all these people talking, but you can't make out any like distinct conversation. That's what I used to get, loads. And again, kind of assumed it was just normal and that everybody got that. Obviously, growing up, now I realise probably not that normal. So I, as a little girl, was terrified constantly, and I couldn't actually tell anybody why, because, well, I don't know why I was terrified all the time. I think something happened and I've kind of buried it away somewhere in my memory. But yeah, as a child, I could not be left alone, which was extremely annoying for my parents at bedtime. There always had to be somebody stood outside my door until I fell asleep. Yeah, and I never really knew why. I just put it down to being a very nervous, very anxious child. But when we started our podcast, Spine Chillers and Serial Killers, I put on my Facebook, has anybody got any spooky stories they want us to talk about? And one of my old school friends from England messaged me and said, "Well, surely you've got a ton of your own ghost stories after everything you went through when you lived in Yorkshire." And I was like, "I have no idea what you're talking about." And she said that I'd told her as a little girl, so at this point I'm probably more 7, 8, that every night a little old lady and a guy that looked like a soldier would walk through my bedroom wall and stand at the end of my bed. And apparently I told her that in all seriousness. I told her I was scared to go home. I didn't want to go home. I didn't want to go to bed at night, because this was happening to me every night. And she remembers it because obviously she was then terrified by what I told her. But I have zero recollection of this. So I guess if that was happening to me, that would explain why I was such a nervous and terrified child. And also, talking to a psychic medium friend of mine, she actually brought up the fact that possibly, you know, all that loud chattery noise in my head possibly our house could have been some kind of a portal, and that if that many spirit was passing through and I was picking up on them, because I do think that children are psychic to an extent, that would explain why I was just hearing this constant noise. So yeah, that's pretty spooky. So now to the manor. So that was in our house. It was on the grounds of the manor house. So now the actual manor house itself. Now, this is nothing I have personally experienced, but it's things that have been told to me by my dad and my mum, who, you know, they have no reason to make stuff up, especially my dad. He was a very tough Yorkshire guy, you know. He just wouldn't make this up. So when we first moved, my dad actually met the vicar of our little village where the manor hall was. And the vicar said to my dad, it's getting close to Halloween. Do you want me to pop over and try and calm things down a bit? And my dad was like, what do you mean calm things down a bit? And he just said, well, you know, the spirits down at the hall, they get a bit agitated this time of year. And my dad was really taken aback. He didn't really know what to say. He thought he was having him on. You know, he didn't think he was being serious, but he was being deadly serious. So that's one conversation that happened. So apparently it was quite known that there were a few spirits hanging around the manor house. So to try and explain a little bit what the hall was, student teachers would go there for courses. And they would go for multiple days. So it had accommodation, it had bedrooms, it had a restaurant. It had everything to be able to, you know, put up people for multiple days. So one day there's a big conference and there's about 50 people in this conference. And they all look outside and they all see a little stable boy walking where the old stables were. The old stable buildings that had now been transformed into bedrooms. And anyway, they all saw him, these 50 people, clear as day, saw this little lad, probably about 14, 15, with his flat cap and his high socks and his brown breeches, walk all across the courtyard and then just vanish. Now, again, you know, they told my dad, oh, what, you know, are you putting some kind of activity on today? Is there like a theme or, you know, have you got people dressing up in the old style clothes? And my dad was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. We're not doing anything like that today. So yeah, they'd all seen somebody who didn't exist, basically. Now, to me, now I've been delving more into the paranormal, I wonder if that wasn't a time slip where that little lad had actually momentarily just slipped through time and he was actually just going about his day, and then all of a sudden he was in our modern day time and then he slipped back. Or if he was just a ghost, or was it just residual energy? I honestly don't know, but I do know that there are 50 people in that conference and they all saw that little boy walk through that courtyard. There was also the caretaker of the hall, who lived, again, on the grounds, but he was a lot closer to the hall than we were. And he said often, I mean very often, he would hear horses, like horse sounds coming from the stables, like whinnying, kicking buckets. And one time he heard a horse and carriage come up the entrance to the main hall. And when he looked, he couldn't see anything, but he said he could hear it clear as day. He could hear the hooves. He could hear the wheels turning, and yeah, so again, residual energy, I'm not sure. But he had quite a few experiences at night when everything was shut up and nobody else was around. So another time, there was another conference, everything went fine, and my dad went to check that everything had been okay. You know, he was a really nice guy, my dad, and he just wanted to check that everything had gone okay and everybody was happy with everything. And he went to talk to the guy who'd been giving the conference, and he said, you know, did it go okay? Everything, were you comfortable? Everything all right? And the guy said, yeah, everything was fine, except this one door that just kept opening constantly. No matter how many times I closed it, you know, you need to get that looked at because it's quite annoying and it creaks when it opens. And my dad looks at him like really confused, not knowing what door he was talking about. So he says, take me into the room and show me the door. So they go in and the guy goes up to the door, and then they see that the door was actually painted shut. There was absolutely no way the door was opening. And This poor guy who's given the conference had no idea what to say. He was like, I promise you this door was opening all the time. It was really actually annoying, as almost as if it was at a slant and I couldn't keep it shut. And actually it was just painted shut. So again, no idea what happened there. One of the spookiest things that happened actually happened to my granddad. So as I was saying, this manor could accommodate people. It had bedrooms and a restaurant, etc., etc. So when my grandparents would come over for Christmas, they actually would stay at the hall instead of staying at our house. As I said, it was a 5-minute walk and we didn't have enough bedrooms in our house, so they stayed down at the hall. So one morning, I don't know, probably about 6 a.m, my granddad wakes up and there's a little girl by his bed, and she's probably about 6, and he's not fully awake, and he just automatically thinks, oh, it's Emma. You know, she must have wandered down from the main house to come and see us. And then as he kind of wakes up a bit more, he kind of notices that this little girl is wearing a bonnet and does not look like me. And this little girl is just smiling. She's not doing anything scary or anything like that. And apparently she reached out and she touched my granddad's hand. And as she touched him, a woman walked through the wall and picked her up and then just walked back through the wall with her and disappeared. So my granddad didn't tell this to my grandma. In fact, I don't think he ever told my grandma what had happened, because she'd have never come back. She'd have been too freaked out. But he did tell my parents about it. And my dad said, you know, it's really strange because that block of building where you're staying used to be the nursery for the family that lived in the manor house. So yeah, it made perfect sense. So yeah, that was a pretty spooky one. One more. My mum was driving away from the hall one day, and as she kind of turned around to look at it, because it was a beautiful building, as she turned around to look at it, she saw a woman stood in the window. And when she got home, she said to my dad, is there anybody in the hall today? And my dad said, no, there's nothing on today, nobody's working. And my mum said, well, there's a woman in there. So my dad says, well, I'm pretty sure it's no one alive, but I'll go and check. And he did. He went and checked and went through every room, and there was nobody in there. So I don't know what my mum saw in the window. Oh, and also the spookiest thing of all, there was a lady who worked in the kitchen. She was a lovely lady and she'd been working there for years. And she actually quit her job because one day when she was wiping down the kitchen, cleaning everything, a Roman soldier walked through the wall right in front of her and then just vanished into thin air. But what disturbed her the most, because she knew the hall was haunted and she knew stuff was, you know, weird stuff was going on, and she was quite a tough lady. But what bothered her the most about this particular moment is that as he walked through the wall, all that walked through was like his torso and head and shoulders. He didn't have any legs. From what I can gather, sometimes ghosts stay on the level that like their ground would have been when they were alive. So like a Roman soldier, I don't know how to explain it. Obviously, he just stayed on the level of his road and was just passing through the building like it didn't exist. I really don't know how to explain it. But yeah, so the fact that she saw just like a torso and head and shoulders, that pushed her to the limit and she actually quit her job. So yeah, spooky stuff. So I really hope you enjoy that. As I said, I'm Emma from Spine Chillers and Serial Killers. You can find us anywhere you like to pod. And Michaela, keep up the good work. I'm loving your podcast. All right then, stay safe, don't kill people, and keep it weird. Bye.
Hey Emma, thank you so much for sending in that story, or bunch of stories, should I say. It sounds fascinating, and I think when I was a child I would have been terrified of those things too. But thank goodness your friend remembered all the things that you saw when you were younger. At first I did think that it might have been the college that I went to, which also used to be a teaching college called Bretton Hall College in West Yorkshire, in Wakefield. But the more I listened, the more I realised it was probably somewhere else. But still, How fabulous, and thank you so much for sharing your stories. If anybody else has got any stories like Emma's or very different to Emma's, then please do send them in. I really want to start playing more of your experiences on the podcast. Don't forget to send in a voice message to paranormal... What am I talking about? Oh dear, I think I forgot myself there for a second. What is my email address? Paranormal or What Podcast at outlook.com. Also, you can go to the Anchor page, which is anchor.fm/paranormal or what podcast/message. And if you just very quickly sign up to Anchor, it will allow you to record a voice message for me to put directly on the podcast. So please get sending in your stories. And again, thank you so much, Emma. I really appreciate the time you took to do that. And everybody who sends me a story in, of course, will get a mention on the podcast. Cheers.
Hey guys, this is Eric and Jessica Carrier, the hosts of the Prairie Land Paranormal Podcast.
If you're looking for a show that explores all things paranormal, with dramatic storytelling, historical research, relevant science, and witness accounts,
check out our show online at www.prairielandparanormalpodcast.com or through your favorite podcast player.
Okay, my lovely podcast people, well, that's it for this week. And it was a really good episode. And I think that it was definitely Emma's entry that made it that little bit more special. So, I hope you have a good week this week. And don't forget to rate and review the show. We want to try and get some more listeners. Also, please persuade your friends to send in any recorded experiences or emailed experiences that they might have had. That would be really cool. I really enjoy listening to your stories. And remember to send them to paranormalorwhatpodcast@outlook.com or record your stories on the Anchor website at anchor.fm/paranormalorwhatpodcast/message. Well, until next week, enjoy yourselves, stay spooky, and have a good time if you do any ghost hunting, like me. Take care, and remember, together we can figure it out. Night.